Guess I'm gonna jump with him. Sorry.
That's right. New World is small.
Yeah.
Ladies first.
Sorry.
Counsel, call a case, please.
Good morning, Chief Justice Moon and other distinguished members of the Discord. This, is a very, fundamental issue that, affects many injured workers. And I'd like to, begin by just focusing a little bit on the basic benefits that injured workers have before proceeding to the case. And I think it would make the case flow a lot easier if I proceed that way. And first of all, under the benefit scheme under Chapter 386, you have the wage loss benefit portion. You also have the right to reasonable medical care services and supplies. And then in the course of the recovery period, of course, you have the third component, which I consider a vital component under the workers' compensation law. And that component involves the right to vocational rehabilitation to restore an injured worker, to the best as possible to reenter the labor market. After that, you have a determination made on whether a person is entitled to permanent partial disability, which is based on a schedule scheme, like a broken finger, a leg, an arm, or things of that nature, or you're deemed permanently totally disabled because you're no longer able to work at all. You also have, finally, this other portion, the disfigurement award, for surgical scars, burns, and the like. I won't get into the death benefit side because that doesn't apply in this case. But these simple benefits, have complicated components as well involved. And for example, one illustration would be, under 386-89, there's a safety net, in the event that a mistake is made in a case. If there's a mistake that's made or there's a change in the condition of an injured worker, the director has the right to reopen the case and look into the case and determine whether the injured worker is entitled to further benefits under the law. And, that's consistent with the remedial statute as a social legislation and the humanitarian purpose of the law. Now, what we have here is my client was injured in 1992. Okay. She went back to work, even though she didn't want to go back to work. But, the employer had someone pick her up, came to her home, and told her that we need to speak to you to investigate your accident. And on the way down to work, she was told, we need to stop by your doctor's office to determine, whether you can indeed work or not. But, as they went along, they went directly to the workplace. And was told to sit in a room, and she stayed in the sitting room. And then the supervisor came back and told her, the doctor said you can work. If you wanted to work and you voluntarily come to work, you have to work. And so she was forced to work. And she's been working ever since that day until the date she was fired down in October 2000. Now, you know, there, when she was fired, you know, we applied for, you know, vocational rehab, you know, to get her employed. The Department of Labor initially upheld that she was entitled and eligible, you know, for vocational rehab services. And that was based upon the recommendation of the doctor, who found that her condition was deteriorating. That was based on the professional opinion of, you know, a veteran, you know, vocational rehab counselor that was, you know, suggested by the employer. And so things moved along. And then in November, the employer wrote to the vocational rehab counselor telling her that, you know, the employer will not be responsible for the cost of the vocational rehabilitation. Eventually, you know, the employer then wrote to the Department of Labor and challenged my client's eligibility. The VR unit upheld it at first and then denied it, went to a hearing before the Director of Labor, and the Director of Labor deemed my client ineligible for vocational rehab services merely because we have this administrative rule that says that if a person collects a permanent partial disability award, you're not entitled to any vocational rehab benefits. The statute itself, however, 38625, nowhere suggests any condition at all that anyone can be disqualified for vocational rehab services merely because you collected a PPD, a permanent partial disability award. If you go back historically, even as far back as 1963, when Professor Rosenfeld came and was commissioned to do a study on workers' compensation law in the state of Hawaii, he himself noted that we were having problems at that time. And this was in 1963. And that was the first time that we're having already in place voc rehab. But at that point, vocational rehab was not under the umbrella of the workers' compensation statute. You know, we had an agency, the DVR branch, you know, vocational rehab branch, a Department of Human Resources, where they would farm out injured workers to do, you know, get retraining. And I would reference this. It's a report number 1963, the study of the workers' compensation law in Hawaii. And in that study, Dr. Rosenfeld talked about vocational rehab and how it was going on in Hawaii and why the law should be codified and redone and re-implemented. And so that's how we started putting a vocational rehab under the work comp statute. In the initial stages, you know, the vocational rehab process, you know, provided for very limited training. You would have things such as books, maybe transportation, some equipment or things of that nature. And monies were paid out of what they call the special compensation fund. And that's the super fund that's under the workers' compensation statute, where everyone, every employer contributes to a little bit, to fund, for things such as delinquent employers or other needs, such as benefit adjustments and things of that nature. Eventually, it evolved, into the present law where the employer is responsible, for the payment of vocational rehab expenses. But along the way, we have, the Department of Labor issuing this administrative rule that disqualified my client. At the same time that this rule disqualified my client, the Department of Labor also implemented another, adopted or promulgated another rule, which states that, this is under 12-1446. The employee is not precluded from enrolling in any approved future program if the director, based on the physician's medical reports and other information, finds that the employee's injury or illness is such that rehabilitation is feasible. So not only do we have a contradiction between the statute and this administrative rule that if you collect a permanent partial disability award, you waive your right to vocational rehab. But we also have in the administrative rules themselves, at the time that they were adopted, an inconsistency, between the rule that disqualified my client and other injured workers for 25 years now.
In this particular case, did the director, after your client received the 8% PPD, did the director determine that she was qualified for VR?
There was a determination made that she was indeed eligible and qualified for vocational rehab services by the VR unit.
Okay, so was the rule that you just mentioned, 12-1446, was that a rule that was complied with, that the director did determine that it was feasible for her to have VR?
I have no idea because what the VR unit relied upon, other than the fact that there was a counselor, there was a physician who filled out a functional capacity evaluation indicating that my client can sit for 2 hours, stand for 2 hours, walk for 2 hours, lift no more than 20 pounds, she made a determination after my client had a trial period of working at the ILW part-time, trying to do some clerical work to find employment and to determine what skills she would need to compete in the labor market.
Well, what I'm trying to determine is there is a department or disability compensation division, and I understood that that particular division made a determination that your client was eligible for VR services after the PPD rating. And my question is that, in essence, the director making that determination? And if so, then it seems that the Rule 22-1446 is being complied with.
The statute actually provides that the director may refer a particular injured worker for vocational rehab services. The determination, however, is made by the vocational rehabilitation unit.
Within the Department of Labor.
Within the Department of Labor.
Okay. In essence, is that how the director acts? I'm not certain about when you say the director may do this or may do that. Is it through the particular divisions of the Department of Labor
okay.
that the director acts?
Okay. Maybe I can clarify it by indicating, okay, you have the Director of Labor, okay, and within it you have all these agencies, TDI, unemployment, and the like, OSHA, HIOSH, then you have the Disability Compensation Division, and within that division itself, you have the VR unit, and that's the organization of the Department of Labor, under the workers' compensation scheme.
So when the rule or statute says that the director, if he or she finds it feasible that the claimant go to VR, then the director himself must issue a order of some type?
There was one issued declaring that my client was eligible initially.
From the director?
From the VR unit, which is, operating under
okay.
the director.
What date was that?
I believe that was in November in 2000, shortly after she was terminated. When the vocational rehab counselor met and interviewed the client, went to see the doctor, got the restrictions, survey the labor market as to what type of skills she has or may not have, and then made a determination as to whether she could or could not, help her. And then she made a determination that she was indeed feasible for full rehab.
And again, that was after the PPD rating.
Yes.
Who?
Thank you.
Had your client then been referred to VR post termination and arguably pursuant to Section 38625 and HAR 121446, who would have been responsible for paying the cost of the VR? Would that be the employer or the special comp fund?
Under the present law and the law in effect at the time that my client was referred to vocational rehab services, it would have been paid by the employer.
Whether the referral was pre or post termination?
Correct. The irony to this whole case, though, is that we have a Supreme Court case, the Kyocho case, that indicated, if an employer provides you, and it's 16, Kyocho versus Allied Maintenance Services, and it's 103 Hawaii 62, decided November 20, 2003. And in that case, this court ruled that if an employer offers an employee work, and they offered this person light duty 2 days after the injury, and gave notice that they would cut off his benefits, he is not entitled to any wage loss benefits, nor would he be entitled to VR services because you're no longer TTD. You know, so my client never had the chance to exercise the right to VR because she was always employed, although at light duties and modified duties, and even though periodically, she could not work. But they kept her on the job all that time.
Which version of the statute applies to your client, 386.25? Is that the version that says the director shall refer employees or the director may refer employees?
The director may.
Why is that? What do you tie that to?
I believe that the change occurred, and this is just my understanding, that when they established the Volk Rehab Unit, the Volk Rehab Unit makes the determination on whether a person is eligible for VR services or not. And therefore, the shall by the director was taken out and the may was placed in.
Yeah, but how does that relate to your client's case? Should the statute that was in effect at the time of the injury apply?
Correct.
So the injury took place when the statute said the director shall refer?
In the early days, it was shall, because there was no VHAB, there was no Volk Rehab Unit, I believe. I may be mistaken on that point.
Are you certain about that? I mean, in 1993, the version in 1993,
yes.
Right? Was it may or shall? 1998 was the...
I believe it was may.
Right.
Yes.
In 98, it was shall.
Yeah. No. Before it was shall, and later it was changed to may.
The injury occurred in 92.
The injury occurred in 92.
So the statute said shall until 98.
Yes.
So shouldn't shall apply?
Well, that's the problem we're having. Everything is based upon, supposedly, the date of the accident. For example, you use the date of accident to gauge what is considered suitable and gainful employment. So you use the wages that she earned in 1992.
The application of the statute that we're talking about, 386.25, looking at the ICA's decision, what version did they use, and how did they get to that? Isn't it that when the date of disability occurs is when the statute applies, whatever the statute is at that time?
It should be on the date of the accident.
So the date of accident was in
92. Yes.
So the 98 statute wouldn't apply.
It would not be.
For purposes of the question, whether Administrative Rule 1214.36 is compatible with the statute pursuant to which it was promulgated, 386.25, does it matter whether the statute says shall or may?
No. I don't believe so, because the whole purpose is the statute was intended to be remedial. There's a liberal interpretation that should have been given, and the rule that was promulgated is inconsistent by tacking on a condition that is nowhere found in the entire statute that precludes an injured worker from exercising their statutory right to vocational rehab services.
Well, the other, I think the respondents make the contention that you have no right, and so they rely on the fact that the statute says may, depending on what version of the statute you're talking about. So they're saying you're claiming a right that you're not entitled to, since the director has discretion on whether or not to refer. So that's why the term shall or may has some significance.
I understand that. Yeah.
So what's your position? Is it shall or is it may?
My position is it shall, whether you read it in whatever context, you know, and it's based on the fact that it should be given a liberal construction.
Yes, but this court hasn't always given worker compensation cases liberal construction. So,
no.
I mean, you have to assume that's how a court would proceed.
Yeah.
But what's your basic contention is because it says permanent disability, it doesn't exclude partial permanent disabled persons?
Yes. Yeah. If you look at it this way, Justice Acoba, I think that, you know, it makes, you know, logical sense that my client, you know, is most deserving, you know, of having the right to vocational rehab services.
How do you answer the respondent's argument that because permanent partial disability is given to account for physical impairment, then it's not tied to lack of earning capacity? And since it's not tied to impairment or diminishment of earning capacity, vocational rehab shouldn't be afforded or is not required. I mean, I assume that's their argument. I may not have been as articulate about it, but what's your response?
If that's the way the law would work, in all cases, you know, we would have, sincerely, a broken workers' compensation system. You know, you would have people day in, day out, you know, that may have prematurely received a PPD award, and then later on be deemed unable to work at all because their condition may not be stable, you know, or the condition may have changed and deteriorated further down the road, and be without a job and no retraining. And that's what would happen. You know, we would have a major social policy at that point. And that's exactly what happened in this case for my client. You know, eventually she became a ward of the state. She was on MedQuest. You know, she depleted all her earnings. She borrowed all monies from family and friends. She almost lost her home, you know, a small apartment that was a leasehold apartment. I mean, that's what we would have. Instead of having, you know, giving people hope, dignity, you know, and a chance for retirement, putting money into Social Security, getting a pension, having a bright future down the road when you retire. Which policy do we adopt?
Mr. Chang, the Attorney General was asked by the Director to file an amicus brief in this case, right? And the Attorney General took the position that the offer that was given by the employer for VR was actually a contract, that there was consideration given for that particular offer. Was that a position you took?
I did not take that position, Your Honor. Justice Moon. You know, my
They felt that it was a binding contract. That's what the AG said, yeah. Right?
My position has always been that it's a statutory right a statutory benefit. It's a compensation, as defined by the law, in the definition section of 386-1.
What specific language do you rely upon which indicates that even after the claimant receives PPD, that VR is available?
Because my
386-25 tells you that.
Because there's nothing that tells you otherwise. There's nothing in 386 that states that you cannot exercise your right to vocational rehab services. And like I mentioned earlier, you also have the safety net in case there's a mistake or change of fact or change in condition of an injured worker. You have the safety net under 386-89. And I've always argued throughout this case that it was premature, to have done this, award. I believe that it was well known by everyone around that she would not ever be able to last in this job. If they had promised her that she had a permanent job and they would keep her on the job, that might have been different. But no one told her that she had a permanent job. In fact, no, let me retract that. She was never told that her job was not permanent until after she collected her PPD award.
Who initiated the request for the PPD award?
It was just scheduled, I believe, by the Department of Labor in the course of time.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Which job was permanent? And who told her that? You said that she was told that she had a permanent position, but it was after?
No. No one. She had always been working.
Yeah, she was on light duty.
Yes.
Okay.
But it was a permanent, she was considered permanent light duty or permanent modified duty. And then after she received her PPD award, let me get you the correct. When, in 1997, and this is undisputed in this case, she then, worked, 3 days in a row, was injured, went to the doctor, and the doctor put her on, disability for a few days. And that was the first time that she was told this was a transitional job only. And even then, the medical records show that there was dialogue going on between the employer's representative and Dr. Okamoto, my client's primary treating physician. And this is in the record on pages 284, 85, 90, and I think 278 as well as 291, which reflects that period where she was off for a brief period and the dialogue was going on with the employer and the doctor about whether she can continue working or not.
But you're saying that the light duty work that she was doing, and this is during her PPD rating, right? Wasn't she there doing this light duty work when her PPD rating came in?
Yes.
Okay. And this was made permanent, you say? That was a permanent position for her. Is that right?
That was my client's understanding throughout the case.
I mean, what's the evidence of that? Is there evidence of that being made a permanent position for her? It wasn't transitional anymore.
The issue was never arose until after the PPD award came out. And she went to the doctor.
Okay, after the PPD rating came out, you said that her position, the duty position, was made permanent. That's what I understood you to say.
No. She understood the position to be permanent before the PPD award. After the PPD award came out, she was then told it was not a permanent position.
For purposes of your client's potential access to VR services pursuant to 386.25, does it matter whether the light duty job she was doing was transitional or permanent?
It really, in the final analysis, doesn't matter at all.
So whether the position was transitional or permanent as a matter of objective reality or not, or as your client understood it or not, is really neither here nor there with respect to the ultimate question of your client's right to potential access to VR services. Is that right?
The reason why I say that is with the caveat. She could not exercise her right because she was employed. So long as you're employed and the employer accommodates you, you cannot exercise your right to vocational rehab.
Let me restate my question just a little bit.
Okay, Justice.
If the issue is whether HAR 1214-36 is lawful or not, is the answer to that question affected in any respect by the nature of the light duty job that your client was assigned?
Can you rephrase that, Your Honor?
Does it matter whether your client's light duty job was transitional or permanent with respect to the question whether HAR 1214-36 is a legitimate application of 386.25?
It would be, in the sense that if you had a permanent job, you wouldn't need to take vocational rehab.
1214.36 provides, in relevant part, an employee who has been issued a PPD award by the director is determined to have waived the right to rehabilitation. You take issue with the legitimacy of that, do you not?
Yes.
All right. Would you take issue with the legitimacy of that under any circumstances, whether at a particular time your client was in a transitional job or in a ostensibly open-ended one?
In either case, I would.
That was what I was trying to ask.
Mr. Chang, I'm confused. You say if she had a permanent position, she wouldn't be seeking VR.
Yes.
Right? So to answer Justice Levinson's question, it does make a difference if it was transitional, her position, or permanent, because if it was permanent, she wouldn't be looking for VR.
No, but in the end, though, the fact that she was terminated is when...
I understand that, but during the time, that's why I'm asking you, did she receive a permanent position after she received her PPD rating? Because if she did for that period of time...
She didn't. She was told that the position was transitional.
But if it was permanent, she wouldn't be receiving VR, correct?
Correct.
And she understood it was, even after her PPD rating permit.
She was told eventually that it was not going to be a permanent job.
Okay.
Yeah, and so that's what's the complication is. It's the timing, I think, the timeline that makes the difference.
Okay. Your time is up.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Ms. Helen.
Chief Justice Moon, if it's acceptable to the court, counsel for the employer and I have agreed that I will go first and we will split the
fifth, that's fine.
The half hour.
Thank you.
May it please the court.
Excuse me, Ms. Sellers, I don't mean to interrupt you, but... We've learned from bitter experience that if counsel doesn't speak directly into that mic, what we hear on the tape is silence.
All right. I appreciate that. Well, on a sample sentence here, my name is Dorothy Sellers. I'm here this morning with Francis Lum from the Department of the Attorney General. We represent the amicus state of Hawaii. What I would like to do in this argument is to briefly set forth what we see the facts and then explain to the court why 1214.36 is valid and serves a purpose in the statutory scheme. The claimant was injured 16 years ago in 1992. Between 1992 and 1995, she received temporary partial disability, temporary total disability, and permanent partial disability, each of those covering a separate time period. She never asked for vocational rehabilitation at that time because she really missed very little work, and she was back with her employer, and those disability payments that I mentioned were at sporadic intervals during that three-year period. She never asked for vocational rehabilitation until late 2000, after she was terminated by the company, and that claim was denied as untimely under 1214.36, first by the Labor Appeals Board, and that was affirmed by the ICA. Okay, this brings me to why the rule is consistent with the statutory scheme under the rulemaking powers of 386.72. Here is what we need to focus on. If you look at 386.31 and 386.32, one dealing with partial and one dealing with permanent disabilities, they both say one thing. They both say at some point that payments for permanent partial disability cannot commence until the termination of temporary total disability. So this brings us to the question of what is temporary total disability and how does it end? Temporary total means the employee is in a state of flux. The employee is not able to work. We're waiting for the employee to improve, for the condition to stabilize, for the condition to get rated, and the outcome is simply not then known. What the statute clearly says...
Well, there is temporary partial disability, as you've indicated.
Right.
So in addition to the situation being in flux, by virtue of it not having stabilized, the claimant is also unable to work.
Well, under the partial temporary. The claimant can work, but maybe fewer hours a day, or maybe at a different job.
If the claimant is deemed temporarily, but only partially disabled, the claimant is able to work. The medical situation being in flux. If the claimant is deemed to be temporarily but totally disabled, the claimant is unable to work and the medical situation is in flux and as yet unstable, correct?
I think that's correct. I think under the partial temporary that the medical situation is also in flux.
Flux is a constant. Whether the claimant is able to work or not during the period of flux determines whether that temporary disability is partial or total.
I think that's right. But I think the important point here is what the law says about when temporary total ends. And it says the payment of such benefits, this is 38631, and they're talking about temporary total. The payment of such benefits shall be terminated only upon order of the director or if the employee is able to resume work. And then that ties in with the two provisions that I previously mentioned, where it says you don't get permanent partial until temporary total has ended. And temporary total doesn't end until you're able to return to the workplace. And the reason that the administrative rule makes sense is that that it only bars the right to rehabilitation for people who are back in the workplace. And people like the claimant here who are back in the workplace and who are making at least the same and slightly better wages than they made prior to the accident are barred because they are back in the workplace, and it's perfectly consistent with temporary total disability, and it's perfectly consistent with 38625.
Ms. Sellers, does the issuance of a PPD award presuppose as an absolute that the claimant is back in the workforce?
Yes, it does, because it says clearly that after termination of temporary total disability benefits, an injured employee who resumes work may be entitled to permanent partial disability. But it doesn't say, and it says it again in 38632, unconditional nature and time of condition of payment. Compensation for permanent partial disability shall be paid regardless of the earnings of the disabled employee subsequent to the injury. Payment shall not commence until after the termination of temporary total disability.
So let's assume that the period of temporary total disability is at an end because the claimant's medical condition has become stable.
Yes, that's
therefore the claimant's condition is not temporary.
Right, she's back. Because the claimant's able to work.
The claimant's condition is no, I don't think that's not my understanding. My understanding is that the period of temporary total disability ends at such time, among other things, as the claimant's condition is no longer temporary. In other words, the medical condition has stabilized. It has, barring some unforeseen development in the future, become a permanent condition. And at that point, the question becomes whether it is a permanent partial condition in the sense that the claimant's earning capacity has not been completely impaired, or becomes a permanent total condition, meaning that the claimant's working capacity has become completely impaired. Do you share that understanding?
I share part of that understanding, Justice Levinson. The part that I think is clear by statute and merits our agreement is the payment of temporary total shall be terminated if the employee is able to resume work. And so all that I'm saying here is that the statute So the sequence by statute is you have temporary total. It's terminated because you're able to resume work. You are then getting, you may then receive permanent partial disability, which really has nothing to do with your earnings capacity.
But that a claimant is not totally impaired on a permanent basis and therefore is theoretically theoretically has some earning capacity remaining and therefore potentially could return to work does not necessarily mean that the claimant does return to work, does it?
It says it a couple of ways in here, but I think it says if the employee is able to return to work. So basically what the position of the state here is, when the use of acceptance of permanent partial disability to cut off the claim for vocational rehabilitation is not an injustice to the employee because that person at that time is able to return to work.
Is the actual return to work a precondition to eligibility for a permanent partial disability award?
I think not. It says if the employee is able to return to work.
All right.
That's what you.
So that
I can't guarantee.
I know anecdotally, having done a lot of workers' comp on the claimant side in my time, and I rather suspect that you know anecdotally too that many, many, many claimants are awarded PPD and yet do not return to work.
I don't know anecdotally. I don't. This is my second foray
Fair enough.
This area.
The statutory scheme does not require that the claimant return to work in order to be eligible for a PPD award. Isn't that right?
They have to be capable of returning to the workplace. They have to be stabilized. They have to be rated. They have to be capable of returning to the workplace, and that's what happened here.
And so your position is that 12-14-36 is legitimate because a claimant who is not totally disabled is capable of working and therefore is legitimately ineligible for VR services.
I think that's right, because the prerequisite for permanent partial disability is being paid off first on temporary total. You're not temporary total anymore. You're through it, you've stabilized, you're done, you're ready to return to the workplace. And if you look at subsection B of 12-14-36, it specifically reserves the right to vocational rehabilitation to people who are still on temporary total. It's when you end the temporary total, because the temporary total ends when you're capable of returning to the workplace that justifies the that dovetails with the cutoff on VR, because you're back in the workplace, or you're eligible, you're capable of being back in the workplace.
How does that square with the plain language of 386.25, which provides that the director either shall or may, depending upon the time we're talking about, refer employees who may have suffered permanent disability for such physical or vocational rehab services as are feasible? I mean, doesn't the statute on its face contemplate the possibility that a claimant who is PPD may get VR services?
No, I think that might be an overread of that statute. I should also say that we think the may applies, the 1998 May version of the may shall quandary applies, because this employee is tied to when you make the request for VR, which never happened here until 2000.
But doesn't 12-14-36 transform the may into a may not?
No, I think, Your Honor, let's go back and look at 386.25B that you were just reading. It says, who in the director's opinion, or who may have or have suffered permanent disabilities, and who, in the director's opinion, can be physically or vocationally rehabilitated. But the point, the purpose of the that statute is to, the purpose of the vocational rehabilitation statute is to restore the person's earning capacity and return that person to the workplace. And that's what happened in this case. She was restored. She was returned. She wasn't losing money. So why should she get vocational rehabilitation when she's back on the job? She's completed. The TTD has ended because she's capable of going back to work, and that's when she got the
So are you question. Are you hanging your hat on her capability of returning to work, or the fact that she actually returned to work?
We have both in this case, because she couldn't get off TTD until she had stabilized and been assessed. And so in this case, she had both. And I think if we had a case where I had to choose one or the other, I would say, even if you're just capable, but you haven't gone back, but you take the PPD, you can't go back for vocational rehabilitation, because someone has adjudged you capable of going back to the workplace. You are ready to go back to the workplace. Yes, that's the answer.
So I think it makes a difference. It may make a difference here, but as to whether we use shall defer or may defer. Now, I'm not sure what position you're taking in terms of which version applies to this case.
Our position is that the 1998 May version applies.
98? Why 98?
Isn't that when it changed?
Well, why? The injury took place in 92.
Yes.
In 92, the statute said shall.
Yes, sir.
And so the isn't it the rule or the law that says that the date of injury or disability is when the particular law applies, whatever law was in effect at that time, and the ICA used when the injury manifested itself, and didn't it manifest itself when the statute said shall?
She clearly was injured when it said shall.
Right.
But she never asked for vocational rehabilitation services that would require the director to make a decision. But when that request came, it was after the may had been substituted for the shall. And so I think she was that the request should have been in, that the request for vocational services should have been adjudged by the law then in effect.
The section that Justice Levinson focused on and just read to you from 386.25, which used the word shall,
yes,
states have suffered permanent disability. That was her situation. She suffered permanent disability, and this was during before 1998. Is that right?
Yes, and she took those payments between 1992 and 1995. But it goes on to say, may have suffered and shall be referred for such physical and vocational rehabilitation services as are feasible. But our point would be that at the end of that three-tier disability income process that she was in between 1992 and 1995, that she had passed the point, I think, of rehabilitation services are feasible. She was back in the workplace. She was making her salary. So, this is not a candidate for vocational rehabilitation. This is someone who is capable of and, in fact, did return to the workplace.
Ms. Sellers, do you agree that when she returned to work, it was light duty and it was not a permanent situation, that it was transitional?
I agree it was light duty. There seems to be some disagreement as to who thought what when about whether it was permanent light duty or permanent position, or maybe she should go back and...
What Wasn't there a letter from the employer that explained to her that light duty was not permanent?
Right, but I think that was like a 1999 letter, or maybe a 2000. There was a series of them in 2000, but there was a gap that I think Mr. Chang pointed out, that people had differing expectations.
Wasn't that the letter that indicated that this was the foundation for saying that she would be let go? Right, because we don't have permanent
right
work.
Right,
and she was let go.
Right, and that's what they said in 1999 and 2000. But from the time she returned there, well, actually, she never really left, but all up until the date of the injury, that 8 years before she was fired, I'm sorry, sir, I can't answer the question, because I think no one wrote down what their expectation was about the permanency of that job.
I get a feeling that you've gone over your allotted time.
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, it may not be. How much time does this always have? How many? They're splitting the time between them. Oh, so she's going to handle everything?
No, I was going to handle 15, and I've apparently infringed on
how much total time do they have? Total time? 30 minutes. So it's 15-15 is among this, and she hasn't hit 15 minutes yet? You didn't mean to do that.
No, okay. I did not.
Good.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Ron Leong, and I'm here with my colleague Stacy Uwani. And we're here on behalf of the Appellee Weyerhaeuser Company.
Mr. Leong.
Yes.
Let me ask you a question I wanted to pose to Ms. Sellers, too. We just look at the statute. The statute says permanent disability. It doesn't qualify permanent disability for whatever reason. This petitioner would fall within the broad term permanent disability, wouldn't she? As being eligible for PR.
Yes.
So that if the rule on its face excludes someone who is permanently disabled, even if partially, as opposed to, I guess, totally permanently disabled, then doesn't that rule on its face conflict with the statutory language?
Justice Kolb, I would agree that it would if that's what the rule is. It's our position that the rule in and of itself is more procedural. It is not substantive. The rule merely excludes you from VR once they request, they meaning the employee, the injured employee requests and receives PPD. Until that point in time, the rule does not exclude someone who is permanently, who has a disability, a permanent disability, from seeking VR. The facts in this case.
But in any particular situation, you might not receive a disability award until you were physically stable or medically stable. Is that correct?
That's correct, as far as
then
the
PPD. Then you may not be able or capable of embarking on vocational rehab or whatever until your medical condition was stabilized.
That's not correct. If you look at 386.25B, Your Honor, it reads that, and whether it's may or shall, it's irrelevant here, it says the director may or shall refer employees who may have or has suffered permanent disability.
No, that doesn't exclude our situation.
I'm sorry?
That doesn't exclude our situation.
No, because she may have, and in fact, the facts in this case show that she was injured on July 8, 1992.
It says, or have suffered. So in either case, depending on when the director decides to do it or to exercise his discretion to do it, all that means to me is that the director has different options. He has a couple of options. He can do it either before the rating or he can do it after the rating.
Or he can do
and
it
the situation may be that he won't do it before the rating because her medical condition obviously is not stabilized.
Well, I don't read 386-22 as minimized in her ability to seek VR only once there's a medical stability on her part. I mean, if you look at 12-14-23, there's even a provision for self-referral where the employee himself or herself can initiate, it says, select and initiate the process.
That doesn't preclude the petitioner from going under this section, does it?
No. I think they in fact, work together. I mean, this section...
Not in the initiating, they don't waive their right.
I beg your pardon?
By not initiating, the employee doesn't waive.
Exactly.
Correct.
They do not waive. It's just one of the ways in which this process can begin. And that's why, from an employer's point of view, the claimant had ample opportunity, as the ICA found, up to 4 years in which to have requested voc rehab.
Mr. Leong, let me go at it this way. For purposes of 386-25B, an employee who may have suffered permanent disability is still temporarily disabled, isn't that so?
Could be.
Well, how could it not be? Oh, I suppose the claimant may be temporarily disabled or not disabled at all.
Or not disabled at all.
All right, but those are the only two possibilities.
Correct.
All right. And an employee who has suffered permanent disability is no longer temporarily disabled. Isn't that so? By definition.
At that point, yes.
It would be oxymoronic to say that an employee who has suffered permanent disability is simultaneously temporarily disabled, wouldn't it?
Yes.
All right. And so does not the statute clearly give a claimant who has suffered permanent disability potential access to VR services?
Yes, it does.
What's the magic of receiving some money that is intended to represent the rough equivalence of the loss of a claimant's earning capacity?
Because as an employer see section 12-14-36 as, it's a procedural aspect initiated by the director to enable the statute to provide a closure to the permanent disability cases as it relates to VR services. Without section 12-14-36 in place, as the regs and the statute now reads, Your Honor, there would be no endpoint. The ICA pointed out that when the statute was passed, and their words were there was a void left by the statute's silence on the time by which an employee with a PPD would have to obtain VR services. So by way of a hypothetical, if 12-14-36 does not exist on the record, under the current statutory and regulatory scheme for voc rehab, a person could be working on a light-duty status, receive PPD, get 2 years after that, be terminated for some unrelated reason, but still on a permanent partial disability status, then apply for voc rehab at that point. There would be no cutoff point. So you'd have all these open-ended cases out there. Open-ended implies additional costs, implies additional administrative nightmares, and I think that's what the regulation at 12-1436 was intended to do, is to find some endpoint. I do not find that procedural intent by the director to be in violation of any of the aspects of the intent of
VR. Isn't there a substantive component to it as well? I mean, if there comes a point beyond which a claimant is deemed no longer potentially eligible for VR services because, as a matter of law, the claimant is deemed to have waived the right to VR, That's the loss of a substantive right, isn't it?
It's a loss of a right, but it's based upon an election by the employee at that point. It is not foisted upon them without the ability for the employee to address that issue and to dispute that issue. That's why I say it's more procedural than substantive, because substantively this regulation or this rule does not change a person with a permanent disability's right or access to VR. Substantively, they have the same very broad, very liberal interpretation of the statute as intended by the work comp statute to provide somebody with permanent disability or who may have a permanent disability with the right and access to VR.
So that if I lose my right leg, which equates to X percent impairment of the whole person and renders me permanently and partially disabled, but my employer is giving me desk work so that I don't need my right leg to do that light duty, a legitimate interpretation or application of 386.25 is to require me to make an election between the receipt of the PPD award reflecting the loss of my leg to which I am entitled on the one hand, or seeking VR services on the other?
Well, in a case like that, if that employee who had lost his leg was back at work with his employer, working on a desk job, as you said, if that employee, that VR is not something that is mandatory. If you look at 325-C, it says it's not mandatory. It's an elective on the part of the employee. So in the situation that you give, Your Honor, that employee has a choice. If it's back at work at a job that he or she is satisfied with, then yes, he or she can elect for
But if PPD. If I take my PPD award and then later decide that, you know, I'd really benefit from some VR services to assist me in the use of my prosthetic right leg so that I'm not desk-bound, according to 1214.36, I've waived the right to VR services.
Yes, you would have, but the statute doesn't it require you to exercise that right at any time specific. It gives you that elective right. If you determine that you're in a position that you're not satisfied with, there's nothing that says you have to make the decision in 10 days or 20 days or 30 days. You have that right to make that decision if you're satisfied. But you are correct that once you make that decision, then you are precluded from it. But that's what brings closure to this. The entire statute, however broad or liberal the intent of the social insurance law is, provides the director with numerous and repeated instances where that director has to make decisions to limit the rights of the claimants. And this is just consistent with the intent of the statute. There has to be some limits.
So the statute and this rule, too, doesn't provide for any election procedure and doesn't provide for any waiver procedure. All it does, it just says, fait accompli, if you get PPD, then you lost out on any VR benefits. So it was curious to me that the ICA and I guess the state's position is, well, this in effect legislates a deadline. But, you know, there's nothing in the statute and there's nothing in the rule which indicates, well, employee, you ought to know that you have a deadline and that you better get your VR before you get your PPD award. But there's nothing that warns or notifies the employee that that's the case. All it says is, well, once you get PPD, you're out. And there's so many, I would think there's situations you can think of where the fact that you got a PPD award doesn't necessarily mean that you don't need VR. PPD award, I guess, only compensates for physiological impairment, right? Not for lack of earning capacity.
Yes, I don't think that the intent of the rule as it is intended or as it's practiced, it means that once you get PPD, you don't need VR. The rule only says that if you want VR, make an election. Make an election before you go and seek indemnity under the Act.
I'm sorry. It doesn't say that in the statute or in the rule that the employee shall make an election, and if the employee fails to make the election, then the employee waives the right to VR.
No, what I'm doing is, I mean, if you look at the rule, that's how the rule is in effect implemented, right? That you and the employee are noticed, as the ICA's decision had indicated, that if you elect to secure an award of PPD, then you have deemed to waive, in the language of the rule, your right to VR at that point. It's closure.
Physical incapacity and loss of earning capacity are not mutually exclusive, are they?
Not necessarily.
And in fact, isn't workers' compensation as a construct grounded in the proposition that extent of physical disability is the measure of the extent of loss of earning capacity? Whether that's a legal fiction or not, isn't that the conceptual underpinning of workers' compensation?
I don't know if it's a if it's a underpinning of the statute or the understanding of the statute, but I don't find that inconsistent with what the position that we've taken here today.
Well, I suppose one potential problem for you would be that the mere fact that one is compensated with dollars for loss of earning capacity doesn't relate rationally to the utility of receiving vocational rehab services if they can be of benefit.
Your Honor, the rule is not substantive in nature. It's just a procedural. It's a point in time to cut off when your rights to VR is established. It doesn't prevent you.
Isn't that where it becomes substantive, where it cuts off?
To the extent of cutting off is substantive,
right,
yes, absolutely.
Okay.
But it doesn't change, when I say substantive rule, it doesn't change the standard, if you will. It doesn't change the standard as to whether you permanently disabled, have access to VR. It doesn't change that. It just says, at a point in time, your right ends.
The problem in this case is because she waited so long for VR. Is that right?
The problem, the problem in this case from the claimant standpoint is after 4 years,
right,
she elected not to seek VR, even though she, the facts are such that she was on temporary total disability, which clearly gives her right to VR under the statute since September 1 of 1992. Her injury was July 8. So,
take a case where we're not concerned with the length of time. That, let's assume that this person did it very timely, and yet, like in this case, the director indicated, or the Department of Disability Compensation indicated that this person, it was feasible for her to have VR. So take this person who is on TTD, she's off TTD, she immediately gets PPD, and it's apparent and obvious that if she gets VR, she's going to be increasing her ability to earn. But because she had that PPD, she is out automatically under this particular rule. And as I think the justices have pointed out, the language just seems to indicate in the statute that if you have had permanent disability, you're still eligible for VR.
Yes, Your Honor, I don't think anything you said would be disputed or is inconsistent with what the rule is, because if your comment implies or is intended to imply that the award of PPD is something that's automatic and out of the control of the claimant, then yes, I think it would be inconsistent with the intent of the statute. What I'm saying is the award of PPD is not something that's automatic. It's something that the claimant must participate in, either by requesting or have the right to object to at a hearing if so required. If that claimant elects, because it's not mandatory to have VR, if that claimant elects, then that claimant, if it has been deemed to be feasible, would have that right to continue with VR, notwithstanding the fact that they would have had a permanent disability.
I'm sorry, Mr. Long. You agree in this case the claimant did elect?
I'd say in this case the claimant did not elect for 4 years until after the PPD was granted.
But when her employer offered it, she did elect?
Not until after the offer was withdrawn, and she
accepted before the offer.
I'm sorry?
She accepted before she was terminated, right?
No, she was not. The facts of the case is that she did not accept and communicate her acceptance to the employer before she was notified of her termination in accordance with 378.32 of the statute.
Okay. Yeah. The way I read the facts was she accepted on the same day that she was terminated. Is that correct?
No, that's not correct. The facts are such that she apparently had informed the provider. She never told the employer before she received her letter of termination.
The provider being?
The counselor.
The VR counselor.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chang, you have anything else?
Yes, I just have two very brief topics. First, the election proviso that Mr. Liao mentions, I believe, wasn't applicable at this point in time for this particular accident. The second point I wish to emphasize is that there is that safety net for these contingencies that we're talking about under 386-89. And the more important point is that the transcript does show that the human resources director, Mr. Okuhara, did inform my client to take your time before you select a vocational rehab counselor. And the facts do show that on October 13, 2000, there was a discussion that she asked for a date of October 25, 2000, to make a final determination. I'm going to take VR, but I haven't decided on a counselor yet. And I'm going to see the doctor on the 25th, at which time I'm going to have an MRI and X-ray, and I'm going to find out more about my back. And at that point, I would make my determination. The human resources director who replaced Mr. Okuhara said no. So then the discussion was, okay, why don't you give me to the 18th? So over the weekend from the 13th, Monday morning comes on the 16th at 9 o'clock during a break. She calls up the counselor and tells her, I'm going to select you as my vocational rehab counselor. Not knowing anything else, believing that the 18th now is the deadline, she comes back in the afternoon and is escorted to Mr. Maeda's office, handed a termination letter saying that she refused voc rehab and her paycheck. And that's what happened in the end. And that is what is in this. And Mr. Maeda says differently, but we have a witness that wrote down exactly what took place. There was a witness to that, Mr. Polly.
So she was terminated by letter on the same day?
Yes. She made the selection in the morning. In the afternoon, she was terminated. But the agreement was not the 16th, but she informed the employer by the 18th.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Justices.
We'll take this matter under advisement.
Rise. Honorable Court of Appeals.